Me oh me, oh my oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
It's the return of Western Skies, a monthly news and culture magazine that takes a look at issues facing Colorado and the West. This month, we're taking a look at, well, the Old West. We'll hear about the myths and realities of cowboy culture.
There were no cowboys ever fighting Indians. That's really silly.
Hear about a place built on keeping cowboy sensibilities alive.
Never had a paper route, never was a brain surgeon, did nothing but be a cowboy and then write about being a cowboy.
And we'll visit the site of the Sand Creek Massacre.
These things are relevant to us today, and the real lesson is we can't forget.
All that and more is coming up on Western Skies. We'll be right back.
Out here on the front range, looking for a good old time. Me and my friends are headed a little further on down.
Me, oh me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for tuning in to Western Skies, a collaboration between the news department and the Big Something here at KRCC. I'm Andrea Chalfin. One of the most pervasive notions of American cultural identity is that of the Old West and the myth of the cowboy. This month, we stick a magnifying glass up to those notions to see where they originate and where they continue to resonate. First, KRCC's Tristan Dickison stopped by two visitor hotspots in the Pikes Peak region, namely Garden of the Gods and Manitou Springs, to ask locals and tourists about the American West and how Colorado figures in as part of that legacy.
I'm Darcy. Actually, when I think of the West, I think of Colorado immediately. Yeah, everybody wears cowboy hats pretty much and horseback riding and the mountains.
My name is Zoe Lynn.
And can I ask where you're from originally?
Colorado. I think of the wagon trains going over the mountains. I think of the Indian culture along the Platte and other areas. I think of the beautiful blue skies. I think of the cattle drives. These all went into what made Colorado what it is.
I'm a third-generation Denver native. My name is Scotty Bauer. When people saw the majestic Rocky Mountains here in Colorado, realized maybe we should just stay here in Colorado. So a lot of folklore has come from that. Well, we've got Doc Holliday from OK Corral. He's buried up in Glenwood Springs in Colorado. Buffalo Bill is just up the street from where I live in Denver.
I don't know about folklore, but the people here are a lot more Western-minded, like West Coast.
And what's your name?
Bobby D. the Third.
Bobby D. the Third, where are you from?
Kansas.
Kansas, all right, so it's more Western than Kansas.
Yeah. Oh, yes.
What's your name?
Stuart.
Stuart, where are you from originally?
Massachusetts.
What's different from Massachusetts?
Vast expanses of land, kind of uncharted. It has the open, sprawling plains and whatnot.
And what's your name?
Camden. I think of cowboys and Indians.
Ghost towns and just the attitude of the people. You can very much tell it's still a little bit wild. But it's just Colorado. And it is part of the West. Definitely.
That was KRCC's Tristan Dickison speaking with visitors in Manitou Springs and the Garden of the Gods. So as we heard, there's a lot of cultural identity surrounding the American West. To talk about some of the origins of these notions and the myth of the cowboy, we're joined this month by Kim Walker, professor of digital film and media arts at the University of Colorado at Colorado Springs, Anne Hyde, professor of history at Colorado College, and author of the recently published book Empires, Nations, and Families, which details the American West from 1800 to 1860, and Matt Mayberry, who directs the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum. Matt also sits on KRCC's Community Advisory Board. We begin with Matt Mayberry answering the question, what does it mean to be Western as it relates to the American West?
I think that's changed over time. I mean, prior to the Civil War and just after the Civil War, it meant settlement. It meant a chance to rebuild your life. I think that changes as you go through the decades and the West becomes settled. It's now a place where you relocate to. It's an urban center. I mean, one of the definitions I've heard of the West is that it's more urban than any other part of the country because there are fewer opportunities for agricultural activities because of the nature of the aridity of the West.
Anne.
Well, I, to reiterate what Matt said, I think that a lot of it has to do with this reinvention of self. And I think that's a big image in film and literature as well, this notion that it's a sort of blank slate in which you can reinvent yourself. But I think that's where the sort of myth-reality problem enters in, because it never actually is a blank slate for all kinds of reasons.
So let's talk a little bit about the characteristics of the cowboy. What makes a cowboy as part of this myth, and where does it come from?
Well, to take a very local perspective, I always think, when I think of the myth of the West and the cowboy, I think of the Hank the Cowboy sculpture that's downtown in Colorado Springs. And it's this slightly larger-than-life cowboy reading the Gazette Telegraph. And it's drawn from the Pike's Peak Bust Rodeo and the range rider tradition here in Colorado Springs. But that's a wholly invented activity that really has very little to do with the tradition of Colorado Springs. And it actually, the rodeo, the local rodeo in Colorado Springs, evolved out of a flower parade, which I just love the juxtaposition between those two images. And so to me, I mean, certainly the cowboy is an iconic figure in the American West and belongs in the American West. I think it's somewhat difficult to really get a grasp of the cowboy tradition in the Pikes Peak region, and I think in other parts of southeastern Colorado. It just doesn't seem to fit here to me.
Where do you see, either Kim or Ann, the origins of this cowboy myth, and what are the characteristics as they pertain to Colorado?
The best example I can think of, what I'm probably most familiar with, is the John Ford codification of the cowboy myth, and it said that he invented John Wayne, and the John Wayne character from the Ringo Kid through the Searchers is a pretty stoic, arguably violent, but powerful, man of few words, man of action. And Ford put his stamp, I think, on the Western by suggesting that there was a certain cowboy code. Cowboys were kind to women and children. Cowboys were patriotic. They knew how to handle themselves. If the authority, the law was 3 days right away, they would often take circumstances into their own hands and, of course, complete the conflict within a two-hour film. So that's part of a simple beginning of the codification, I guess. Mm-hmm.
I think I take it further back, because I think it comes directly out of the Civil War, because there's a tradition, Beatles dime novels, which were the things that people carried, you know, the young soldiers are carrying in their back pockets during the Civil War, where characters like Calamity Jane and Buffalo Bill and all those folks. And I think you can see a direct line from that sort of complete literary fiction to things like Owen Wister's The Virginian, which is right at the turn of the century, and that feeds directly into that John Wayne image. So it never seemed to come out of actual cowboys, which is kind of interesting. There's a sort of literary trope about it, but there aren't any really model cowboys. Maybe Teddy Roosevelt is a model cowboy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think what the dime novels and the movie tradition for the cowboy culture leaves behind is the diversity that existed. You know, the fact that a lot of it is derived from Spanish and Hispanic cultures. African American cowboys are all but absent in that tradition, and so we lose a lot of the texture, the richness of what actually happened in the American West in terms of cowboys.
What are the factual basis for this codification that has appeared in film and literature, etc.?
Well, there was an actual cattle industry, and they actually needed people to, well, they stole horses from Mexico, and then they brought them north and sold them in the Chicago railheads and places like that. So cowboys were responsible for taking the purloined animals and getting them north. And that involved a lot of, you know, individual stick-to-itiveness and, you know, all of those kinds of things. But these were really hardworking people who were part of a corporate industry, which is another part we seem to leave behind about this.
Mm-hmm. And you're saying it's an industry, but am I hearing you right? It's an industry of theft?
Pretty much, yeah.
Well, it's also trying to capitalize or commoditize the the vast open space of the American West and try to figure out how to turn prairie land into a paying proposition. And
now, Kim, films came about post-Civil War, obviously, but the Western itself was an actual early genre of film. Why do you think that filmmakers sort of latched on to that notion of the Western for film?
Well, that's a good question. I've heard it said that if films were religion, we would get the most out of Westerns because they were simple morality plays, good and evil. The beginning of the Western was, I think they were called oaters, O-A-T-E-R-S, or horse operas, derisively, meaning that many of them had very simple narrative structures. There might be a robbery or a stagecoach holdup, and then a cowboy might sing a song on his horse and take off after the outlaws and bring them back to justice. Later, that would kind of erode and become more vengeance-seeking than justice-seeking, but that was a corruption of the original code, I would say. But I think people like Ford felt that they were that was satisfactory in the beginning for them to be that simplistic and basic morality tales, but he was interested in doing something more with a narrative form, mm-hmm. And he did.
Anne?
Well, I wondered, one big shift I think maybe happens in the 1930s, the landscape all of a sudden becomes really important. So in a film like The Searchers or Stagecoach or any of those John Ford ones, all of a sudden you see that very iconic Western landscape, which in the early Oaters, I don't think that was – the landscape didn't play as much of a role.
Some of the original Westerns were shot in Florida, believe it or not. And then as the country kind of expanded west, the film industry expanded west. And, I think there is something to Ford's notion that he wanted to shoot, you know, real men, real violence, realistically in real locations. So I think eight or ten of his films were shot in the Monument Valley, which is very much based on the iconography.
Why did the land become such an iconic character?
Well, I think some might argue that it probably has to do with this idea that there is no longer a frontier. And Frederick Jackson Turner and what he called the frontier thesis, that the frontier closed in the 1890s. You no longer had open space that you could seek out and reinvent yourself. And I think it's a sentimentalizing of that idea that you could always move west. Well, after that time, according to the frontier thesis, you couldn't.
Well, there's something inherently powerful about having a stranger ride in from the frontier or from nature and appear again on a 40-foot diagonal screen. And he's set in a very isolated image. I mean, the frame shows him as a couple of pixels by today's comparison in what is a vast, expansive, sometimes vertical, but a horizon that goes on forever. So that gives you that sense that if something happens to him, if he's attacked by savages, he'll likely be savaged by the time it's over.
You know, one of the, I don't know if romanticized is the correct word, but I think one of the most romanticized conflicts of the American West is that between cowboys versus Indians. What's the reality of this area?
Do you really want us to answer that question?
Yes.
Go for it, Anne.
Well, one thing, there were no cowboys ever fighting Indians. That's really silly. There were military men fighting Indians. There were settlers sometimes fighting Indians. But cowboys and Indians, I have no idea how that ever came about. So we could stop there. But here, Colorado was a place that could not be settled until the military came in and removed the Indians. So they used reservations. They used blunt force. There were almost no reservations in Colorado compared to other places. The Arapaho and the Cheyenne on the Front Range were shipped off to Indian territory. So it was made into a blank stage for homesteaders and cities by active force.
You said it could not be settled, but... So that leads me to believe that there were hostilities towards the settlers who were coming in.
Well, we just finished commemorating the 150th anniversary of the Gold Rush. Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to put it in that perspective. The Gold Rush was about trying to get out here, extract the gold, and then initially go home. It wasn't so much about settlement of Colorado in the very first blush of it. And in that first rush period, 1859, I don't know of any examples of conflicts between those people who are settling the state coming here to seek gold and the American Indians who had treaty rights to the territory. What changes that dynamic is after a year goes by or after 2 years goes by and these people aren't leaving. And so it's this idea of treaty obligations, treaty rights to land that is then being settled by an influx of people who are not taking the gold and leaving, they're staying. And it's this creation of society, creation of a territory that really forces that issue.
The cowboy and Indian is this duality, though, in film. And I'm wondering, you know, Kim, as somebody who studies the film industry, was that just a product of convenience?
It makes great action. I mean, if you've heard an arrow whistling through the air or you've listened to the pounding of war drums, I think that's very dramatic. In the hands of John Ford, at least, it's a pretty poetic statement. I think it does make for good chase scenes. It seems overly simple, but many of those films were pretty simple.
Mm-hmm. Pre-westward expansion, and by westward expansion, I mean en masse. Are there stories from that time that sort of somehow pick up, some of the characteristics can be linked directly back to pre-civilization, quote-unquote?
Well, you could look at a place, maybe, like Bent's Fort, which is, you know, founded in the 1830s. But this is a place where all kinds of people met. In fact, Bent is married to a Native woman. There's a whole history of various people marrying various people. And there's no competition over land. It's when Anglo-American notions of property and what land is used for come in that all shifts. But I think that notion of the fort where people came together, that's a true borderland. It's right on the Arkansas River. There are Mexican people, there are Anglo people, and there are, you know, a lot of Native people. So there's maybe that's a version of this that's local.
Something that you just said, Anne, wasn't until the Anglo-American notions of land and land ownership that came into this area that these conflicts arose and that these issues arose. I think that stands in a really interesting contrast with the whole notion of the cowboy drifter, though, who doesn't own property, who doesn't own land, who visits but never stays. And I'm wondering how that particular piece of the cowboy notion or the drifter notion sort of co-opted these other values that weren't really a part of the Anglo-American experience.
I wonder if it has all to do with getting away from women. Because that's so central to that cowboy story. And if you own land and you have a farm, it's going to become Little House on the Prairie, and the women are going to come, and there'll be children, and you have to stick around. So if you don't own land and you drift from place to place, you can stay in this place where Eastern values and domesticity and all those things don't come and ruin your life. Mm-hmm.
Kim?
I agree that's really part of that myth of freedom, that you get to come in and leave when you want, and you know, you can be the reluctant hero and you can make things right in Shane, or you can make things right in My Darling Clementine, or you can make things right in The Searchers and then leave in some ways because you may be unfit to live in that domestic sphere, but at least in part because that domestic life is an encumbrance to your freedom. It doesn't allow you to come and go. Some of those trappings, it's often referred to as a threat, the threat of domesticity. So it plays into the mythology. We don't want to look at it very deeply, or we'll see these, you know, Western heroes, Western outlaw people for perhaps what they are. But they are easy to identify with, I think, for those people in the 1950s who are feeling some of the encumbrance of moving to the suburbs and raising their 2.2 children and working in a factory, or this really is a very appealing, a very attractive myth.
Why is this image of the cowboy in the West so pervasive? And I'm not just talking about a piece of national identity. It's also internationally associated with what the United States of America is. Why is that?
Well, Hollywood had a lot to do with it. I mean, it was systematically put out there. Probably 150 or 200 Westerns a year, all following a similar form of a stoic, powerful, often violent, appropriately violent would be one interpretation, of real men who stood for something was the idea. And that became an easily, you know, America's cinema became world cinema in part because they were very effective and efficient at production, distribution, and exhibition of these films. They were made within a code, which meant that they became pretty cliche. If you were to look back at them now, it would be impossible to look at them without some serious sense of irony. But they were effective.
Well, it's a positive story about progress hitched to this absolutely appealing, virile story. So what's not to like about that?
I think it embodies freedom, sentimentality, kind of a connection to the past, and this idea of reinvention, the way we started this conversation.
Oh, give me land, lots of land, under starry skies above. Don't fence me in.
That was Matt Mayberry, director of the Colorado Springs Pioneers Museum, UCCS film professor Kim Walker, and Colorado College history professor Ann Hyde. Now, there's a lot of material that simply didn't make it to air. You can hear it all online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies.
Don't fence me in, just turn me loose. Let me straddle my old saddle underneath the western sky.
Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. Now, if the cowboy is nothing more than a myth, no one told the folks at Western Jubilee Recording Company in Colorado Springs. KRCC's Noel Black stopped in one recent night to hear the high lonesome sounds of the Old West.
If you're looking for the soul of the cowboy in the West, you'd be hard-pressed to find a better place than the Western Jubilee Recording Company. Secreted away in a nondescript warehouse on the outskirts of downtown Colorado Springs, the tiny record company's facade belies a magical little theater with old wood-backed cinema seats, a bewildering collection of Western memorabilia, and a private stage where, on this night, two of its artists will perform for a small private audience against a backdrop of crazy quilts, old novelty guitars, and well-worn cowboy hats.
Let's give a Western Jubilee Warehouse welcome to Mr. Waddy Mitchell. Traded for a horse one time who'd never take no beauty prize. He's this long-eared blue roan gilly, but not too bad for weight and size. See, I was making tough old circles.
Waddy Mitchell, a world-famous cowboy poet, looks the part. Bushy gray handlebar mustache and a wide-brimmed black vaquero hat. He's one of Western Jubilee's signature recording artists, and he's appeared everywhere from the Johnny Carson Show to Good Morning America. Packed full of rhyming wit and wisdom, Mitchell's narrative poems might at first seem like little more than folksy yarn spun to conjure cowboy nostalgia for audiences who pine for a mythical West. But Mitchell, who was raised on a working ranch in Nevada and spent his youth working as a cowboy, is the real deal.
Never had a paper route, never was a brain surgeon, did nothing but be a cowboy and then write about being a cowboy.
For Scott O'Malley, who founded Western Jubilee in 1996, preserving the authentic Western sound of artists who were being pushed toward country for the sake of selling records was the first order of business.
Well, we created Western Jubilee in the vision of kind of doing everything just the opposite is our Nashville experience. And that's based on Don and Waddy and the Sons being recorded in Warner Brothers' Western label. And when they drifted west with me, they knew that I understood the difference between country and Western.
Don is Don Edwards.
10 years ago, I left my home to be a city slicker. Take me back to the rain.
And the Sons are the Sons of the San Joaquin.
A cowboy's heart is in the saddle as he hums and rattles in doggone longhorn cattle. Every mile is a smile as he proudly rides a straddle. A cowboy's heart is in the saddle.
Working cowboys are few and far between these days as ranches get swallowed up by developers and corporations. Kathleen Fox Collins is a partner at Western Jubilee who spent much of her career working with the Colorado Springs Symphony. She says songs like these preserve both the myth and reality of the West that speaks to the hearts of those who come here to soak up the cowboy culture.
I didn't really know that the West still lived until I worked here. And what I find is that this becomes a mecca for people who also feel that they are a part of the West.
Tom Wilms, deputy editor of American Cowboy magazine, is one of those drawn to Western Jubilee. He believes the romance of the West is still bound to the real ranchers and cowboys.
And while those working cowboys may not exist in the numbers that they did, I think that myth persists around the globe. You know, you mentioned even just America to a lot of people, and they think of cowboys in the West and that spirit of independence. And so whether that's still, you know, a real thing or not, it's here.
Working cowboys and city slickers alike who've come for tonight's concert couldn't agree more. Here's local horse and landowner Dr. Mike Shields.
It's nice to come down here and see friends and let them just be who they want to be and play just what they want to play.
Al Fryer has been coming to shows here for years.
I just think it's kind of the romance or mystique of that kind of life.
And Mary Ormond, a longtime resident of Colorado Springs, just loves the whole experience.
I think it's part of real life. History is part of real life, and the West and the myth of it is the fun of it all. Love it, really. Why do we live in Colorado? This is our heritage. We love it. So much fun.
Whether it's romantic feelings or a connection to a real way of life, Waddy Mitchell believes it's all worth preserving.
What we're trying to, I think, really hold on to is maybe the little more independent thinking, a little more can-do outlook on life. A wonderful poet named Badger Clark said, you know, I love my fellow man the best when he is scattered some.
As long as places like Western Jubilee keep the soul of the cowboy alive in song, stories, and culture, he hopes, the myth and reality will live on together. For Western Skies, I'm Noel Black.
To see a slideshow of images from Western Jubilee and for links to the music you've heard here, mosey on over to the Western Skies page at krcc.org. Now KRCC's Craig Richardson also went in search of a real cowboy to explore the boundaries between myth and reality. Here, Scotty Hall of Pueblo explains the realities of ranching in the 21st century.
Oh, the cattle are prowling, the coyotes are howling out under the west.
sun up to sundown, you know, if you're worth your salt, you're from the minute you get up, I hate to use the word worry, but that's what I done. You know, you're worrying about your water, especially right now with this drought set in. You're running your water system five times harder than you normally would because they're going to be drinking so much. And the thing about cattle is there's kind of a window. And if they're walking, especially the mother cows, if they're walking any more than half a mile or a yearling you're trying to fat up, they'll walk off everything that they ate overnight. They'll walk it right back off to get a drink of water. Now, hay's getting ridiculous expensive. So everybody's worrying right now what they're going to look to for this winter for feeding. It's a tough deal. And right on the deal when cattle started getting good and the prices were up and you think life's going to get golden, this deal hits and it's, you know, but I wouldn't trade it for nothing. I mean, it sounds like I'm whining about it, but that's the kind of worries that I'll take all day long. And every guy that I know will take all day long. Years back, I stumbled onto a day work job for the ranch north of town. And a month later, I took it over and it was in complete shambles. And we spent a year gathering the wildest, nastiest cattle you ever seen in your life. Even in a good year, they were bad cattle. And got that deal going under control. And then I started running lease cattle. You know, people bring them to me and I run them for them. And we did that for a few years. And then I got hurt and that and damn near killed me. I don't remember none of it, but the kid that was working for me, he said I run up to him and I roped him. He's a big old yearling. When I did, I went to lay the trip on him to lay him down. Well, this colt that I was on, when he kind of slacked up and went to bucking, it let that rope slack up and it jerked me over backwards. And he landed on me and wallowed around on top of me for a little bit. And luckily that boy was with me. And him and his buddy, they loaded me up in the truck and they hauled me into Pueblo. And that's where they thought I was going to croak, actually, in there. So they flight for life me to Denver. And woke up in there 4 or 5 days later. And I couldn't see, I didn't know who I was or nothing like that. Well, they got that settled down, and it had actually dislodged my right eye. I'd hit the ground. They didn't know if it was falling on me or what. Well, it snapped the top of my shoulder off. It absolutely exploded my rotator cuff. It broke my collarbone, my clavicle. It just obliterated all of it and all the muscles, and it stopped just short of coming out the top. And a year of therapy later, I learned to recontrol my hand and my arm and got all that stuff fixed and, you know, back good as new. Ain't any smarter. I still go do what I do, but I'd rather be killed tomorrow having some colt buck me off than I ever would some little kid driving down the road texting and running into me or something like that, you know. But it's a long trip, but you get over it. You just toughen up and get past it. That's all. So many people they look at me as an alien, the way I dress. I got the tall tops and the big hat, and I look like a freak come out of the desert. And what they do is they see those guys like that, yeah, they're young, beautiful fellas and the young gals, you know, and that's the way they say, oh, that's the way of life. You know, they don't even come close to it. That's just a bar cowboy. And that's, I don't mean to cut that, but you know what? Don't look down on me like I'm some weirdo the way I dress when they're not even close to what it really is. This is all function. What you see on me, there's no style about it. Sure, I have the spider web sewed into the top of my boots, but them boots right there, you can go through the walking stick cactus at 100 mile an hour, and I guarantee you ain't going to stick a thistle through there. Now go get your pair of them lightweight ropers and see if you don't come limping out, you know? Everything about it, this big hat, this ain't just because I'm big. It keeps the sun off me and keeps my face getting burned to the ground, you know? I guess if I was smart enough to be a fashion guy, I wouldn't be sitting here with one eye telling you about cattle, but I ain't. The ranch, it sold, and developers bought it, and the economy fell apart, and the ranch sits dormant now, so I went and got a town job, they call them, in my world. It's a different way of life. You know what? I'm very appreciative to have the job I have. I work for the county, and I run heavy equipment, whether I'm in the pit running a big loader or a dump truck or whatever they need me to do, I do. It's a little hard at first to get used to because I'd never had a job like that. But I'm very appreciative to have it and feed my family because there's a lot of guys that still don't. I can say things like retirement account now and paid vacation time. I never had that before. I didn't know how to take a sick day for 8 months because I never took one. So it's a treat. It's just, if I could change it, sure, I'd rather be running the ranch I was on, but I ain't 20 anymore either. You know, I got to think of my family, and that's what you do. And these places are being gobbled up by developers like my way of life was, and it's going away, and when it's gone, it's gone. You know, you can't go tear them houses down and put grass back up and run cattle. It's over with. And it's a heritage thing. I mean, you're raised into it. You don't go to a book and learn how to do it again. You know, I hand it to my boys, and they're going to hand it to their boys. And if they don't want to be a part of it, that's fine too. You know what? If they want to do ballet, I don't care. I want 100% from them. But that's the honesty and integrity that we breed into them from this way of life.
This is the last cowboy song. The end of a
That was Scotty Hall, a cowboy from Pueblo. You can listen to this piece again and see photos of Scotty in his tall top boots and extra big hat at krcc.org. Another piece of On the eastern plains of Colorado, near the town of Eads, is the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site. It marks the place where Colonel John Shivington led about 700 territorial militiamen to an encampment of Cheyenne and Arapaho. By one estimate, at least 160 Indians were killed and mutilated, mostly women and children. I recently visited the site to see how it connects the past to the present and to hear about the importance of examining popular conceptions of myth and reality.
I'd like to welcome you to the Sand Creek Massacre National Historic Site. This site was set aside to preserve and protect the scene of the November 29th, 1864 Sand Creek Massacre. It's a very large area that stretches for as far as 25.
Craig Moore is a ranger with the National Park Service. This is typically how he begins his presentation when visitors come to the site of the massacre.
At this site, or in this area at that time, the most prominent tribes were the Southern Cheyenne and the Southern Arapaho, who had come into this area a generation or two prior to this from the north. And they would be the Indians encamped here along the banks of the creek in 1864 that would suffer at the hands of Colonel Shivington and approximately 700 Colorado volunteer troops.
According to Moore, a perfect storm of sorts was brewing in Colorado. The country was still engaged in the Civil War, and the Colorado Territory remained isolated from the goings-on in Washington. Anti-Native sentiments ran through influential Coloradans and others, including beliefs in Indian inferiority and that all Natives were hostile and needed exterminating. The United States, Moore says, believed it was at war with the Plains Indians. Black Kettle of the Cheyenne was one of the chiefs present at the massacre. He had previously attempted to create peace, even when members of his own tribe disagreed. On that November morning in 1864, Colonel John Shivington led the militia to the camp at Sand Creek.
It would be only a matter of minutes, certainly less than an hour, till the majority of the command of Colonel Shivington would arrive. And in tow, they would have four howitzers. That were capable of firing.
Several under Shivington's command, like Silas Soule and Joseph Kramer, refused to take part. But in the end, Moore says at least 160 Indians perished, mostly women and children. Of the Colorado volunteers, Moore says only a dozen or so died, either on that day or due to injuries from that day. Park Superintendent Alden Miller calls the event a turning point in the history of the West and says the traditional government of the Cheyenne would never recover. Trust between Indians and non-Indians, he says, was also a casualty.
We're walking up to the bluffs. They're on the south side of Sand Creek, about 23.
In 2007, the site became a National Historic Site administered by the National Park Service. Part of the legislation specifically designates partnerships with those with ties to the site, including the Cheyenne and Arapaho. As a memorial, Miller says the Sand Creek Historical Site can help remind us what it means to be human, and in doing so, can help prevent future similar occurrences.
Our humanity shows in what we do. Our world has not particularly gotten rid of conflict, nor competition for resources, nor the struggle, and so too does the struggle for cultural identity continue. These things are relevant to us today, and the real lesson is we can't forget. You know, we have to know who we are, and that's what the Park Service does.
It's that mission that drives Eunice Petromala, an interpretive ranger with the park. Petromala says her heritage as Cheyenne, Mexican, and French brings a different cultural perspective to the tragedy, and that it's important to understand the human condition on all sides.
I try and play into the empathy and not sympathy. I think sympathy is dangerous, but if you can make somebody be empathetic and kind of stand in those shoes, they begin to realize and see the world a different way.
That empathy and understanding helps enable visitors to think about all the contributing factors leading up to the massacre, not only on the side of the Coloradans, but also on the side of the Cheyenne and Arapaho. That's a notion that resonates with Ranger Craig Moore, who says he often asks visitors to identify with one of the historical figures, like Black Kettle or Colonel Shivington.
Given a certain specific set of environmental circumstances, it forces us to ask the question, are we capable under circumstances to do the same type of things that were done on the field at Sand Creek?
The Sand Creek Massacre Historical Site weaves together the past and the present in a solemn way and marks how the past influences the present. Park Superintendent Alden Miller says the lesson comes in remembering.
Sand Creek today is a place that has a special meaning for those who were changed here forever. Their blood runs through this place, and this place runs through their blood. But it is a place where anyone, by virtue of being human, should be able to come here and understand something about who we are.
The site's designation as a National Historic Site is relatively new. Educational centers are planned in nearby Eads, but the site itself is currently open to visitors daily. You can see pictures of the location and hear Ranger Craig Moore's historical retelling of the events of the Sand Creek Massacre online at krcc.org. We'll be right back with more Western Skies. Welcome back to Western Skies. I'm Andrea Chalfin. One of the most iconic symbols of the Old West in film and television is that of the tumbling tumbleweed. But the tumbleweed has a dirty little secret. It's an invasive species. High Country News editorial fellow Emmeline Ausland recently wrote an article about the plant after researchers contacted her regarding studies they're doing to control tumbleweed. I spoke with her about what she discovered about what's also known as the Russian thistle.
Before they reached out to High Country News, I'd never really considered tumbleweed as an actual weed, even though it has the word weed in its name. I think of it more as one of the many plants that I'm used to seeing around the West.
So it is a problem plant.
Yes, tumbleweed causes several problems. It can outcompete crops or native vegetation, and it also dries out the soil. And then when the wind hits and it snaps off at the base of its stem and starts to tumble, when that soil is dried out, it kicks up lots of dust. Tumbleweed causes other problems, too. It can pile up against fences. This is kind of unusual. Not very many weeds or invasive plants do that, but tumbleweed piles up against fences or buildings and creates a real fire hazard because it's just all this dry tinder in a huge heap waiting to ignite.
Is there anything good about it?
I wouldn't say there's anything good about tumbleweed ecologically. The good from tumbleweed is more kind of a perception thing, that it creates this image of a Wild West that people like to see. And people are very attached to tumbleweed and the idea of it.
Let's take a step back here and first kind of talk about how it got here. What is it?
Yeah, tumbleweed is native to Eurasia, kind of Russia, Eastern Europe, Greece and Turkey, those areas. And there are several different species of tumbleweed. And researchers believe that it first came to the United States when its seeds were accidentally mixed into a shipment of flax seeds that some early settlers brought from Russia to South Dakota and planted.
How does it break off from its base?
When it matures, the plant itself dries out, and it just has a very small attachment between the part of plant that's above the ground and the roots underground. And it easily snaps off there, usually from wind, I believe. And that wind also pushes the tumbleweed across the ground. And that's a mechanism the tumbleweed has developed to disperse its seeds. It's really pretty clever. It's covered with thousands of tiny seeds, and it rolls along the ground, pushed by the wind, and all the seeds pop off and get scattered everywhere.
So these researchers contacted you. Is that how this article came about?
Yeah, these researchers are interesting guys. There were two men who I talked to, and they're working at a U.S. Department of Agricultural Research Center in Maryland, actually, of all places. Not exactly the hot seat of tumbleweed, but these guys have been working to develop a biological control for tumbleweed for about 13 years.
What kind of discoveries are they making?
They and some other researchers from their research center traipsed all around this region of the world looking for sick tumbleweed and found a handful of pathogens that appeared to be infecting the tumbleweed and brought them back to their lab in Maryland, where they have this very technical sealed greenhouse. So they brought those pathogens back with them to Maryland and started trying to figure out both how effective they would be against tumbleweed as a way of making tumbleweed sick and controlling the species, and also how safe they would be as far as protecting other species that share the range with tumbleweed.
Is there opposition?
There's not any direct opposition that I know about, but I've seen a couple of websites. I think it's kind of funny, but there are places online where you can order tumbleweeds by mail to decorate your house. And there are other places online that advertise that they promise to protect tumbleweed from development, which they see as a big threat to this iconic species. And they are collecting donations to fund the seeding of tumbleweed in places where it appears to be disappearing. So I'm guessing that people who are promoting the continuation and propagation of tumbleweed are not aware of the agricultural and environmental damage it can cause, or the fact that it is actually not even native to the Western United States. It's just this idea that we have from old Westerns and everything.
Which is kind of brings me to another question, which is, are these researchers aware that they're killing a symbol?
I think they are somewhat aware of it, but they're so absorbed in their own research that they may not quite realize how attached people really can be to tumbleweed. And they also assured me when I was talking to them that even if the pathogen is successful, it won't be able to wipe out tumbleweed entirely.
That was Emmeline Oslin from High Country News. She says the pathogen project has not yet been fully approved. Emmeline joined us from the studios of KVNF in Paonia. You can find a link to her original article and hear the full conversation online at krcc.org. And finally, on the day that marked the second anniversary of the founding of Colorado Springs, the New York Times imagined the wondrous discoveries the Hayden Scientific Expedition of the Colorado Rockies would uncover.
In the Rocky Mountains, the Hayden Party. The highest town in the United States, hunting silver in the clouds. The Hayden Scientific Party, remarkable discoveries. Fair Play, Colorado, Thursday, July 31st, 1873. This town lies at the head of South Park, on the mountain route between Denver and Santa Fe, 95 miles from the former place. It is noted as the supply point for the Mount Lincoln Mining District. Mount Lincoln towers above the place to a height of over 16,000 feet. A wagon road is nearly finished to the top of the mountain, making it the most accessible of high peaks in Colorado. It covers an area of 6 miles by two, and although an isolated and almost continuous elevation, being divided by four slight depressions, has received distinct names, the south end being known as Buckskin Mountain, next Mount Bross, then Mount Cameron, and the north end Mount Lincoln. We find the summits covered with grass, beautiful flowers, and vegetation. It is calculated that there are now about 3,000 miners at work on these mountainsides, most of them newcomers, roaming about with pick and shovel, honeycombing the whole area with prospectors' holes. Professor Hayden and the party are now exploring this region under a commission from the government. The professor visited many portions of Colorado in 1869 and published reports of the same. At its last session, Congress appropriated $75,000 for a geological and geographical survey of the territory of Colorado. The area to be surveyed comprises the entire mountain district of Colorado, about 32,000 square miles. The party discovered in the immediate neighborhood a dozen peaks belonging to the Sierra Madre range that were over 14,000 feet high. This fact will change our Rocky Mountain data somewhat, and Pikes, Longs, and Gray's peaks will have to share their fame with these new heights yet unnamed. It is believed, too, that the party, as they move southward beyond the headwaters of the Arkansas, will discover peaks of still greater altitude. One benefit resulting from this expedition will be the determining of the numberless Rocky Mountain heights, in regard to the altitude of many which there has heretofore been much variance. A portion of the expedition who reached this place by following the range along its base to Colorado Springs, and thence westward, passed through the famous Petrified Forest, which lies near the stage road about midway between Manitou and Fair Play. Within an area of a half a mile, there are 13 petrified stumps, most of which have been almost torn away by curiosity seekers. Aside from the Garden of the Gods and Monument Park, the fashionable denizens of that resort Manitou often seek this famous place and go away with trophies. By the way, we were reminded as we put up for a night at the Manitou House that Colorado watering places are getting to be Saratoga-like, for we noticed the piazza thronged with the elite from the East and Europe, and there, each entertaining a circle of friends, sat Senator Morton of Indiana and J. Edgar Thompson, while many overworked and invalid college tutors and literati occupy neighboring cottages. But to return to the petrified stumps, one of them measured 10 feet in diameter. Still preserving the grain and color of wood, it is yet a mass of solid stone. It bears a beautiful polish. Some of the splinters, though thready and limber, are yet pure stone. At the foot of one of these stumps is a pile of petrified chips, some of them apparently in a state of transition from wood to stone. These discoveries awaken much speculation in the minds of travelers and seem about as mysterious as the discovery of petrified palm trees in South Park a few years ago, when there were none growing within hundreds of miles of the territory. How long it takes for the petrifying process becomes a question. These chips may have been hewn out by the Pike Party in 1806 or by the Spanish expedition under Coronado in search of gold over 300 years ago. The route of the Hayden Party after leaving this vicinity lies into the San Luis Park, and thence into an interesting region, southwestern Colorado, from which several explorers have brought accounts of the existence of curiosity and wonders, ruined cities, fathomless lakes, peaks higher than any yet discovered on the continent, and vast volcanic structures beyond the snowy Sierras. There are said to be canyons walled in by perpendicular rocks 2,000 and 3,000 feet high, boiling salt springs, and beyond the White River, a veritable Sahara, within the boundaries of which is a strange, weird place called Goblin City, where the red sandstone is worn into fantastic shapes. Pyramids, sphinx, towers, domes, minarets, statues, and rows of buildings stretching over a large area like an uninhabited city. This wonderful region will be explored more thoroughly than ever before, and doubtless much of great interest to our future history and the development of Colorado will be brought to light. In the San Luis Park, that wonderful body of water, Sawatch Lake, the largest in Colorado, will be visited and something more of its character learned. It is 24 miles in length and 10 in width. Its waters ebb and flow with the regularity of tides. When at low ebb, it is scarcely more than a swamp, while at full tide, very deep. Some observers have undertaken to show a similarity between its waters and those of the Great Salt Lake of Utah, and as it has no visible outlet, there is a theory afloat of a subterranean communication between the two. The Hayden expedition and their summer's work are likely to confirm or explode these reports and traditions of almost unknown parts of Colorado.
That piece was produced by Craig Richardson and Noel Black. You can hear it again and comment at krcc.org.
Me, oh me, oh my, oh my, I'm looking at the western sky.
Thanks for joining us this month for Western Skies. We'll see you again next month. But we want to hear from you. What's on your mind? Send us an email at westernskies@krcc.org or give us a call at 719-434-3657. Western Skies is a production of KRCC News and The Big Something with producers Andrea Chalfin, Noel Black, and Craig Richardson. Special thanks to the Haunted Wind Chimes for our theme music with lyrics and arrangement by Anea Lujan. For KRCC News and Western Skies, I'm Andrea Chalfin.